All right, it's time for Let's Weekend.
Hey.
Once again, shuffling things up again this week. I'm Patrick Mifflin, of course. I've got Philippe Adinolfo and Brandon Perkins with me this week, and Danrib Victorio might be joining us later on. We'll see what happens there. As far as what we're up to, I guess I'll get started on that one. Largely, it's just been NHL stuff. The draft got started tonight, and there's free agency just coming up next week. So there's a lot to be excited about on the hockey front, and that's kind of been dominating my time. It's even pulled me away from some of my gaming this week.
I guess that's why the show's called Sports Happens.
Yeah. I figured that was a good title for it. And if Danrib comes in, I'm sure we'll be getting some NBA stuff going on in here too. So, so as you know, I'm a Colorado Avalanche fan, and the sort of recurring soap opera that's gone on with the team for the last couple of years has been the contract negotiations and subsequent meltdowns of Ryan O'Reilly. That kind of came to a head these last few days. They wanted to get him signed before going into training camp, but they do, as they have said, we have a structure on this team, which pretty much everyone generally accepts that it means no one's making more than $6 million at least until 2019. Ryan O'Reilly comes up to the table with a contract demand of 8 years and $7.5 million per. The Avalanche respond by going out and acquiring Carl Soderberg and signing him for 5 years at $4.75 million per. Sort of a meet-your-replacement thing. Mm-hmm. And then just tonight, they flipped O'Reilly along with Jamie McGinn to Buffalo for pretty much everything they could have asked for. They got a really good forward, a really good defenseman, a prospect, and the number 31 pick in the draft. So, I mean, that's how you overhaul a team on the fly. And
it's also how you get rid of greedy SOBs.
Yeah. Well, I don't think if I were to really analyze it deeply, I don't think O'Reilly's the asshole. I think it's his agent, because he doesn't play like a greedy player. He doesn't play like a guy who's just coming in to pick up the paycheck. He does care about how the team does, and he is as invested as anyone in the locker room on a game-to-game basis, and especially when you get to playoff hockey. But he also wants to get paid for it, and something going on with that agent. I don't know. Maybe he'll get that $7.5 million per from Buffalo, but he wasn't going to get it out of the Avalanche. So, the 8 year, the max term, I have no problem with, but, the fact that he wanted more than $6 million a year under the current structure was just not going to happen. And I think that was when Joe Sakic knew that he had to cut ties. That's what I've been up to. Just kind of following that. Brandon?
Friggin' Gwent. The game previously known as Witcher 3.
The card game has overtaken the main game.
Yeah. In fact, you
somehow
know what?
I suspected that was going to happen.
It's funny. I probably would have gotten a lot farther in this game by now if it wasn't for Gwent. The thing is, part of the problem is I just have a really crappy deck because it's actually really hard to find cards for the actual Gwent decks, because you can't have your own customized deck, there's like different sets of cards, all of them in particular. Like there's a Nilfgaardian set and a Scoia'tael set and you know, on all that, and it's
so they don't
really
let you construct?
No. And it's really hard to find unit cards for the other couple of decks, because I've got a zillion cards for the authority, but I cannot for the life find any unit cards for the other ones. And it's driving me crazy. But even that, the damn thing keeps just dragging me back into it every time. And I mean, you can pretty much, and the thing is, you can pretty much play Gwent with just about every character you come in contact with. You know, if it's a merchant or a blacksmith or one of the main story characters, or, you know, you can start a Gwent game with all of them. In fact, I am, in fact, eagerly awaiting the point where they make a mod for Witcher 3 where the whole thing is one giant Gwent simulation. In which every single battle, no matter how small, turns into a game of Gwent.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Let's other than that, other than that, I've been into a lot of Japanese rock bands.
I didn't hear any of that.
Sorry. Let me read this one here.
It's not your mic. It's your connection.
It's your bandwidth.
Yeah.
Of course.
Because Skype. So,
sounding like a Cylon now.
Yeah, it's starting to pick itself back up, but we can understand you at least.
Okay. All right. Sound better now?
Yeah.
It's getting back there.
Okay. All right, so anyway, I've been listening to a lot of Japanese rock bands.
Nice. What ones?
Yeah. Well, it started with an old school metal band called Loudness.
Nice.
Which, yeah. If you ever go on YouTube, go look up Loudness Crazy Nights. That particular video was all over MTV back in the mid-80s.
Yep.
You know, the actual music is fantastic, but, you know, it's a Japanese rock band writing English lyrics, so it sounds really awkward. I mean, it's not that the music's bad. The music's really solid, but, you know, it's the lyrics with that accent and it just sounds weird. But, after that, it was, you know, like X Japan, which those guys are, well, you know, they're not, I don't think they're actually around anymore.
Oh, they are.
Oh.
They're right.
So they did, they reformed after Hide died.
Yep. Sugizo from Lunacy replaced him.
Awesome.
And, you know, they've got a new album coming out. Yoshiki's been all over Facebook just talking about all these projects that he's in on, and yeah, it's going pretty strong.
Yeah. Did you ever hear any of the Zilch, that band that Hide started, that was kind of Marilyn Manson-y?
Yeah.
It's actually pretty solid stuff.
It is.
And it's
they did
a shame,
that remake,
you know, what
of,
it,
they did that remake of Drain in which Hide proved that he was no fan of David Bowie.
Yeah. of course, it's a shame what ended up happening to him, but
yeah,
he produced some great music while he was here.
He really did.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I love about Japanese rock bands is how, I guess, eclectic they can be sometimes. Like, yeah. The concept of subgenre doesn't really resonate with them that much. Like, I think probably, like, the best example of this of a band I actually like is, you ever listen to Kaneko Shoujo Tai?
No.
Okay, do you know who Kenji Yatsuki is?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay. If you've ever watched, you know, Hellsing or Sayonara Zetsuba Sensei or Welcome to the NHK, you've probably heard his music at one point or another.
All right, Welcome to the NHK. You got me with that one.
Yeah. Let me just put it this way. I'm going to go over to...
Wait, did he do Odoru Akachan Ningen?
He may have been. He might have. Let me check. But just
I love that song. It's so delightfully insane.
Pretty much it explains all of his music, pretty much. Well, I'm going to go to the Wikipedia page to show you how eclectic the music is. Okay, look at this. You know, Tenchi Shoujo Tai, origin in Japan. Look at all the genres they've got listed here. Hard rock, heavy metal, progressive rock, progressive metal, punk rock, and alternative rock.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And, like, I've listened to some of these guys' music, and it goes from so many different directions, some of their songs. Like, they've got, you know, they might have, like, a really anthemic rocker that right in the minute will suddenly have, like, a classical guitar solo right in the middle of it. It's just crazy stuff. And it's, and, you know, they're one of those bands that sort of started the whole Visual K scene right around that time.
Okay.
So, you know, all of their concerts and stuff, they look absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever watched old anime in the 80s and or early 90s and you ever wondered why whenever there's a rock band or a rock musician on there, why they always look absolutely insane and crazy with the clothing and the hair, well, that's because that's because that's what all the Japanese bands in Japan looked like back then. Another band I've been listening to and is a band called Zamsa, also known as Zamsa and Banshees. It's a alternative rock band that was founded partly by a couple of the guys from an old Japanese pop rock band called Echoes. And their lead singer is this guy named Jinsei Tsuji, who's also amongst his musical endeavors, he's also a novelist and a film director. And I actually have one of his books. It's in English, but it was published in Japan, so I had to special order it from Japan on Amazon. But it's another one of those bands where it's a Japanese band, but it's all in English. So, and it's not that he's a bad singer either. He's got a great voice, especially for alternative rock. But again, it's English lyrics, and he's singing with that accent, so it just sounds weird.
Yeah, it's a little jarring when you first start getting into J-rock. You just kind of have to. It's just kind of one of those things you have to get over pretty quickly, and you know, once you do.
And one of the things I learned really quickly about a lot of Japanese music is, you know how here in the U.S. when we have bands, you know, sometimes they'll have a rock band that'll occasionally throw some sort of foreign word or phrase or something in the middle of a song that's mostly English. Well, the Japanese do the exact same thing, only the opposite.
Okay.
They'll occasionally just throw an English phrase in the middle of a song that's completely Japanese.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of that in Japanese language anyway.
Yeah, and it also explains, you know, why some of their, you know, some of the English shirts they wear just look so weird.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, here in the U.S., I mean, we tattoo, you know, and Japanese and Chinese characters and stuff on ourselves and wear T-shirts and stuff with kanji and stuff when we have no idea what it means, and apparently the Japanese do the exact same thing. With English. I mean, why else would you see it?
I just barely got back from that, and I already know exactly what you're talking about because I've seen pictures of it.
Yeah, like why would you, you know, it's the reason why you walk around on, you know, Tokyo in the street and see teenagers wearing teenagers that wear something like Love and Water or the occasional punk guy that's wearing one that says White Power on it.
Because that'll go off really well over here.
Yeah.
the occasional 8-year-old boy wearing a shirt that says "too drunk to fuck."
Yeah. But I forgot to mention Kenji Itsuki. He's also a fairly prolific novelist himself. Unfortunately, none of it's been translated into English yet, but he's actually won awards for it. And let's see. And I mentioned that Kenji Itsuki had done a bunch of stuff for anime. Let me see if I can finally see. Yeah, I said Welcome to the NHK, Hellsing, Sayonara Zetsubou Sensei. In fact, he did the title theme for Sayonara Zetsubou Sensei.
Find out what he did off of NHK. I think I know the one.
Yeah, let me go on Anime News Network and see if I can look it up on the. Let's see. Yep, here we go. Kenji Itsuki. What song did you say it was?
Odoru Akachan Ningen. It's the ending.
Welcome to NHKTV. Yep. Him and Fumihiko Kitsutaka. That was him. Let's see. He also did the theme song for Eat Man. As far as J-Rock goes, that's pretty much what I've been listening to, and just being absolutely blown away with just how completely different is the American rock scene.
Yeah.
I mean, they really do not give a crap about subgenres over there.
True.
I mean, how else can you explain something like baby metal?
Yeah.
Other than that, my primary thing I've been doing is I've been reading a bunch of stuff by Mick Farren. Just sort of a heads up. Mick Farren was one of the sort of guys involved in the underground UK scene. He was originally the lead singer for this band called The Deviants, that's considered sort of one of the crowning proto-punk rock bands that came out. They were one of those bands that came out in the late 60s, like, you know, the Sonics and MC5, that type, the Stooges, you know, the bands before punk rock was a thing, but were basically sort of setting the whole stage for it.
Pre-Sex Pistols,
pre-Ramones, that kind of thing.
So way back.
And after he got out of the music business, he started writing books. And most of his books can basically be considered as sort of the, much like how he did with the punk scene, he sort of set up helped create a lot of the tropes that you have associated with the cyberpunk genre.
That sounds probably incredibly random.
Mm-hmm. The one thing he's probably written that's had its most impact was he wrote a trilogy of books back in the late 70s called the DNA Cowboys trilogy, which was basically, it has a lot of the sort of common tropes that you'd see in, cyberpunk later on. Things like, things like just random genre splices that go in together, like, multiple world, big corporations, urban decay, that type of stuff. There's a lot of that in there. He also wrote a bunch of stuff, actually. In fact, I think he wrote like over 30 books. And it's funny because back in the 80s and 90s when he was still publishing stuff, they said some of the people saying that he was ripping off guys like William Gibson and Neal Stephenson, even though he's been doing this stuff since the 70s. Ingestion. Matter of fact, he was also still writing lyrics and stuff for bands well into his 60s. Metallica did a couple of his songs.
Really?
A bunch of other bands. Yeah, I think Cyndi Lauper did one too.
What ones did Metallica do?
I'd have to go look it up on the website, but it was stuff for on like Load and Garage Inc. So it was the short hair era. Right.
That would be it. Oh, okay.
There's my puppy. But yeah, that's pretty much what I've been doing today. Well, this last week. Yeah. So what about you, Phil?
Well, this kind of applies to, you know, what I basically do all the time. I listen to a lot of podcasts. Listen to Daily Tech News Show with Tom Merritt, which is one of the guys I'm trying to emulate as far as his techniques on the microphone. And I have more or less, I have some success with it, but, you know, it's going to take me a while before I ever, before I'm anywhere in the same league as that guy. It's something to aspire to, at least, you know.
Yeah.
There's that.
Yeah.
Listen to, sometimes I'll listen to the Giant Bombcast, but God, those shows are so damn long.
Yeah. Like, I think the last one was like 3 hours.
Yeah.
The fact that those were my main influence when we started doing the Day Zero update probably explains everything about those early episodes.
Yeah. So I do that. I listen to audiobooks as well. Lots of audiobooks. I just finished the biography on Elon Musk, which was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
That dude, he's like wicked smart.
Yeah.
You have a chance to check that one out, Brandon. It's definitely worth a read.
Yeah. If I would recommend something to you, I would recommend reading as in listening to. I'm pretty sure they've got audio versions of Isaac Deutscher's biography on Leon Trotsky. It's actually really good. It's long because it's like 3 books, but if you ever get a chance, read it. It's definitely worth listening to.
Yeah, I'll check it out on Audible, see if they've got it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I listen to a lot of music. You mentioned that you were a big fan of Journey, it's like I was kicking myself because I wasn't on the show. So now I can actually talk about that.
And I heard about that later.
You know, yeah. You know, you bring up Journey, I just have to bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
I started listening to Journey when I was in junior high school, you know, middle school. When I was around 13, you know, my mom had the Journey cassette tape. Those of you kids out there, cassette tapes are what we listened to before we had CDs.
Yeah, they were these little cartridge-like things that you put them in the player and then it would eat the tape.
Yep. Then you'd get like a number 2 pencil or a pair of scissors or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing was also, you couldn't pick a track. You had to fast forward or rewind.
Yeah.
And just which was kind of brilliant in its own way because it did make you listen to the entire album.
Yeah.
As opposed to just cherry picking the singles and, you know, like a lot of people do today.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing that, the thing is, though, you know, with vinyl, you actually could pick the tracks, you know, as long as you knew which groove to stick it into.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, I was listening to Journey since I was 13 years old. And you got to understand, all throughout middle school and high school, at least until my senior year, I got picked on by everybody for my taste in music. Because I was all about the classic rock stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so, You know, why are you listening to that old man music? Why ain't you listening to, you know, Creed or Snoop Dogg or whatever? Nothing against Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
I have everything against Creed.
Yes.
But
well,
that's genetic.
Well, Creed did spawn Alter Bridge and Tremonti. And
that's true.
I definitely do appreciate those.
But
I think the main point there is fuck Scott Stapp.
Yeah, that's
is much more
the Bruce Scott Stapp.
Yeah, who's that?
I wish I could have brought a brook. to help me with this huge duke I took. I swear, whenever he sings, he looks like he's taking a crap.
It's true.
Yeah.
All through the years, all the way up to the senior year in high school, I was getting crapped on by everybody for my musical tastes. So I graduate high school. I go into the workforce. And then I'm in my early 20s. And guess what starts happening?
Guitar Hero starts coming all up. All of a sudden. And everybody gets reintroduced to classic rock.
Not only that, but all of a sudden Don't Stop Believin' suddenly shows up on every friggin' show on television.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's on Laguna Beach. It's on frickin' the frickin' Sopranos. It's on Glee. Yeah. You know, it's on every movie trailer. And suddenly everybody's downloading it on iTunes, so much so that it suddenly becomes the number one most downloaded song on iTunes of all time for a short while.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, right, and after the Sopranos ended, it pretty much just shot to the top of the top of the charts.
That's funny.
And all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh my God, Journey, they're so great. The singer's so good. And Don't Stop Believing, it's just a great song. And I'm like, you sons of bitches.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when Rock Band 2 came out, everyone pretended they didn't just spend 15 years shitting on Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I've been listening to this shit since I was a teenager. Literally since I started as a teenager when I was 13. And all of you people were crapping on my musical taste. And now it's that this one song has started permeating the entire pop culture. Now all of a sudden you guys remember, hey, these guys aren't so bad. You know what? Fuck all y'all.
Yeah.
You know, that's what trend suckers do.
To me, it's
even know the truth. You want to know the truth?
What's that?
I don't even think Don't Stop Believing is one of their better songs.
It isn't.
I mean, it's not even one of the better songs on that album.
No, it's not.
Freaking Still They Ride and Stone in Love and all, and, you know, Keep on Running are far better than that song is.
Yeah.
Freaking Open Arms is better than that song. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that it's a bad song, but there's like seven other songs on the album.
Yeah, and they're all really good. It's like, you know, that was a time when you came out with albums that were, you know, really solid back to back. And, you know, Don't Stop Believing was a good song, but there were many others on that album that were just as well. Which I guess begs the question, what are your three favorite Journey songs?
One on the very top is probably Separate Ways, but that's mostly because that's the song that actually got me to start listening. One below that would probably be Keep on Running, and, you know, that song itself is great. Have you ever heard the cover that Anthrax did for it?
No, but now I'm intrigued.
Yeah, you gotta go hear it, because Joey Belladonna, the lead singer, started out a Journey cover band, and he does the Steve Perry thing pretty well.
Yeah.
But you know, on some level, I can actually picture that.
Yeah.
There's actually, I'm sure there's a video of him with Joey Belladonna with the guys in Steel Panther doing Don't Stop Believin'. And again, he's spooky. But the number three song, I'm not sure if you remember. Do you remember the quote unquote comeback album they did in the mid 90s?
Trial by Fire? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember One More?
One More? Yes. So that's a very good song.
Second out. It's pretty much could be the Game of Thrones theme song, honestly.
Yeah.
And it's completely unlike any other song they did in the Steve Perry era.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, that's my top three as far as Journey tunes go. And, you know, that's not saying that I don't love the stuff they did. I don't necessarily dislike the stuff they did with, you know, Steve Augeri and Arnel Panetta afterwards. Though I would say I think Arnel Panetta does it better than Augeri did, just because he can hit the high notes that you know, Panetta couldn't, I mean, that Augieri couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, even my mom, when she first heard that, when they played, when they played Never Walk Away on the radio, she was like, oh my God, did they get Steve Perry back into the band? It's like, no.
Nope.
No, they didn't.
Yeah. So I guess, number three on my list is Separate Ways, obviously, because that's an amazing song.
I don't you just love the video they did for that song?
Yes. Love that.
Man, have you ever seen the video they did for that song? It's
great.
Yeah.
To watch it.
It is the cheapest goddamn thing ever.
that's 80s, though, you know.
Yeah, but even by early 80s standards.
Yeah. It's like no expense spent.
I swear, is it as much as I love it, my voice, is it just me, or did back in the early 80s, Perry look kind of like Pee Wee Herman?
Well, yeah, I guess I could kind of see it. Yeah. Anyways, number
Matt, are you still there?
I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm just muting myself while I drink.
Okay. So number two. So number two is kind of tough because I think it's. Yeah, I think it's got to be one more. It's definitely number two. And my number one is Edge of the Moment off of their last album.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember. Yeah, I've got their last album. I just haven't heard it that much. Yeah. I gotta give that another spin. Yeah. It's weird that of all the sort of AOR bands that were popular in the early 80s, they were the one that sort of managed to come back.
Yeah, because, I mean, they wrote some really good songs that maybe were a little ahead of their time.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, think of all the other, you know, AOR bands that were around in the late 70s, early 80s that were as good. I mean, you had, like, you know, Styx and Foreigner and, you know, freaking Survivor and Toto and
REO Speedwagon
and Boston
and
Kansas.
Yeah. Yeah, they all, you know, kept
Angel,
going and doing their thing. It's just that they didn't.
Magnum.
They didn't get the same kind of, you know, recognition that Journey got eventually.
Yeah, but it's just that one song out of nowhere suddenly became.
Well, isn't Journey like the only one out of all those that never ended up on the county fair circuit?
Pretty much. Yeah. They've always been really popular outside of the U.S., even when. You know, and I mean, there was a few years in the 90s when they didn't tour, but that was because, you know, Steve Perry had left the band and then he had come back and they were doing this, doing the comeback album, which was Trial by Fire. And I watched the Behind the Music on Journey years ago. And the basic story was, is that, you know, basically Steve Perry had gone out on a hiking trip in Hawaii and apparently hurt himself and went back and found out he had this degenerative bone disease in his hips, which, you know, they showed a lot of like B-roll and stuff from when they were making the music video for When You Love a Woman, which was the song that actually got the Grammy nomination that year. Mm-hmm. And he's basically hunched over in agony with, you know, ice packs on his hip.
Yeah.
So, which is the reason why he's never been back with the band. Although it's also been said that, you know, him and the rest of the band just never really got along all that well.
Yeah. I have heard that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently,
of course, you'll also note Neil Sean's a bit of a dick.
I was about to say that. He might be one of the most underrated guitarists in the world, but he's also kind of a jerk.
Yeah, he is. I think he's absolutely out of his friggin' mind, too.
He's mellowed now in his old age. They've been putting out some good music.
Yeah, and you know that the first Steve Augieri, first Arnold Panetta album they put out, the one before the last one, Yeah, that one was actually the first album they had that had gone platinum in many years.
Yeah. Got that.
But
I have pretty much every Journey album on CD here. It's like, yeah. Used to have a lot.
Including of the old feet ones.
Oh, yeah. I got the old Greg Raleigh albums. The three.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Of a Lifetime's a good song. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I didn't mean to turn this into This Week in Journey.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's the show. It's whatever we feel like talking about. So, yeah. This sort of thing is welcomed around here.
Yeah. Well, maybe the next week it'll be This Week in Alice Cooper. Who knows? I'll probably.
Yeah.
Because the same way he is with Journey, I am with Alice Cooper. I have literally every Alice Cooper album on CD.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I play a bunch of games. You know, Defense Grid.
Yeah, we know which games you play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lately I've been playing this game called King Oddball, which is just weird.
Mm-hmm.
You're like this angry son that swings a rock from his tongue and throws it at tanks and helicopters trying to end the world.
That sounds remarkably 8-bit.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a weird, you know, water. I wouldn't say watercolor, but it's, you know, crayon style art to it. I don't know, it's kind of like, it's basically a ripoff of Angry Birds, to be brutally honest. Oh. But it is kind of pretty fun.
Hmm. I'm looking at screenshots. It looks more like less like the sun and more like a moon.
Yeah, could be.
Same difference.
Yeah. It's weird as fuck is what it is. So yeah, and that's, you know, pretty much what I've been doing. Yeah. So a while back, Brandon, you mentioned that you wanted to talk about arcades.
Yeah. Mostly the reason I want to talk arcades is because obviously all of us when we were kids, you know, arcades were still a big thing. And you know, if you go outside of the US and go to places like, you know, Japan and Korea and stuff, you know, arcades are still really big over there. But you know, here in the US, video arcades are all but dead. And that's actually really sad because I think we've lost something very important with the death of the arcade in America. Because before the rise of things like Skype and, you know, Xbox Live and stuff like that, the arcades were pretty much the one part of video game culture that was more, had more of a social aspect than anything else. Yeah. I mean, honestly, you know, you'd have old games with two players, you know, Mario Kart or, you know, heck, even GoldenEye, you know, you'd have three or four people playing. But for the longest time, gaming really was more of a solitary experience, at least console gaming was. And the arcades actually were the more social. And it's really, and the thing people also have to remember, for a long time, the arcades were sort of the vanguard of what the gaming world was. All of the big games that would come to consoles would first make their appearances in the arcades.
Usually a lot beefier than they ended up on console.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, if they went up on console, it took a long time before, you know, console to equal the hardware power of our cabinets. And it took even longer for them to surpass them. So, what I would like to do to start us off is want all of us, including you folks who are listening, to close your eyes for me. All right, you closed them. Now, I want you to imagine that it's 1996, and you're driving in your car. Well, you're not driving. Your mom is driving. And your mom's driving over to, say, JCPenney's or Belk's.
because she needs to get some new weekend wear, because there's going to be a dinner party coming up and she needs to be able to, you know, look good. So she's going to drop you off at the front of the mall, because, you know, those things still existed back then. And you're going to walk into the mall and you're going to go over to the arcade section. Now, for me, the arcade we had at our mall was called Aladdin's Castle.
Yes.
It wasn't terribly big, but it made up for it with economizing all the space that it possibly could.
Yeah.
The first thing that you're going to see when you walk into that arcade is you're going to look to your left and there's going to be a huge big screen arcade cabinet. And usually it's going to have one of the newer fighting games on it. For me, it was usually going to be – it was like usually either Primal Rage or it was one of the new SNK fighting games like King of Fighters or Samurai Showdown.
Oh, I would love to have seen a Neo Geo showcase cabinet. That had to be magnificent.
Oh, we had those down here, too. Oh, they were glorious. And, you know, when you saw all those glorious pixels on that huge screen, it was overpowering. It was visual sensory overload. Yep. Because you could see every gorgeous pixel of every piece of animation that they put into every character, every move, every element in the background. So you walk in a little further, and as you go in further, you're going to look and you're going to see some of the old school classic games like Pac-Man and Galaga, the ones that have been that at that point had been in that arcade for almost a decade, but they still brought in plenty of coins, or in this case tokens, because, you know, they were still solid games.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my case, you know, Galaga was the first video game I played, and, you know, that was because my dad taught me the, you know, the multi-ship cheat that you could pull off. So you go in, but see, that's not what you're gravitating towards. They got all these great games. You know, they might have a Time Crisis machine in there somewhere. You might have a Crane machine and Skee Ball and stuff like that. That's not what you're doing. You're going to the cabinet where all of these people have crowded around. It's Mortal Kombat 3. And everybody that you know in town that plays video games is crowded around this one small arcade cabinet in the corner. And people are just trying to get around each other, trying to see these guys playing the new Mortal Kombat on the screen. And keep in mind, this was old Mortal Kombat, so it was the old, you know, digitized graphics, which in hindsight look kind of pathetic now. But back then, it was still pretty mind-blowing graphically. And here's the thing. Although the internet was a thing then, it was still sort of in its early stages as a commercial thing. So if you wanted to get cheats for any games, especially arcade games, you had to go to the grocery store and hunt down, you know, the video game magazines. You know, stuff like Game Pro, Tips and Tricks, Electronic Gaming Monthly, that kind of thing. And you know, while you're there, there's all these folks who are gathered around, and, you know, they've got the magazines tucked in their back pockets, or, you know, they've got notebooks with the moves all copied down in the paper. Some people just have bits of paper they printed off at Kinko's, you know.
Yeah.
And then you'll find that one guy who's got this paper folded up in his back pocket. And it doesn't look like anything you've seen off of a magazine. You asked the guy next to him, he said, where did he get all that stuff? He said, something called the internet.
Yeah, I was that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you see, that is what it was like in the arcades back then.
Yeah.
because this was the time before virtual arcades, before Xbox Live, before any of that. This was the most social you could get as far as gaming was concerned. Well, video gaming at least.
Yeah.
And this was primarily, if like I said, if a new game was going to be coming to the consoles, it was going to show up in the arcades first, usually at a lesser quality than they were at the arcades. Because, again, it took a long time for the consoles to be able to equal the arcades in power. The closest we ever got was the Neo Geo, and that thing was expensive out the yin-yang.
Yeah, well, I mean, that basically was the same hardware, so...
Yeah, and you know the thing was, this was the age of fighting games. You know, fighting games ruled the video arcades. You know this. You know all. And for the longest time, you basically had two types of fighting games that you got there. There was the ones that copied Street Fighter II, and the ones that copied Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
Now, the ones that copied Street Fighter II almost always came from Japan. And so it was games like, you know, Fatal Fury, King of Fighters, Samurai Showdown. Fighters You'll notice History. A lot of these. Yeah, Fighter's History, Fighter's Destiny, Fighter's Instinct.
Yeah.
Fighter's History in particular is a real oddball, because that one was considered so similar to Street Fighter that Capcom actually sued Data East and won.
Yeah.
I still remember that.
You know, and then, you know, you'd also have the...
Rillo?
I think we lost Brandon. Oh, yeah, there he goes.
All right, we back.
It seems to be trying to reconnect you.
All right.
Okay, you're good.
Okay. And pretty much all the Mortal Kombat games that tried to copy Mortal Kombat were utter disasters. Probably amongst the most infamous is probably Time Killers, which was... We've crapped on that game before on the Day Zero update, and there's a reason. It was a piece of garbage.
It was... I don't think people can quite understand how bad that game is until they actually play it themselves.
Yeah.
Because it was a complete just debacle of a game.
It really was. This game was basically, you know, this was one of the games in a group of games that started the whole violence in video games debate back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, it's funny because, to be honest, the violence in video games debate really doesn't, you know, because games are so mainstream now, it's kind of funny to think that that type of argument used to be really commonplace, and you'll still occasionally hear it now, but it's just that nobody pays attention to it anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was back in those days, they actually had to have a Senate hearing about this. Here in the United States in the early 90s, there was actually a couple of congressmen, most famously the Democratic Congressman Joe Lieberman, actually had a hearing on this in the Senate. And they basically threatened and said, if you guys don't do something about this, we will. And that's pretty much how the ESRB, as we know it, came into existence.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, the games that they complained about, with the exception of Mortal Kombat, they were all utter shit.
Yeah.
I mean, they really were. And it was always the same four games. Just always. It was always Mortal Kombat, Time Killers, Lethal Enforcers, and Night Trap.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Joe Lieberman had a real hard on for Night Trap. I have no idea why, because it was a piece of garbage.
Yeah, it was also completely like taken out of context, which is, you know, what those kind of people will do.
Yeah.
And fortunately, you know, like I said, fortunately, those debates aren't really a thing anymore. But what's, you know, and but thing is, yes, time kill real garbage. And like Phil said, unless you actually play it, you won't really know why exactly. I mean, obviously, if you look at it, it already looks kind of cruddy. I mean, it's graphically inferior to a lot of the fighting games that were already out back then.
Yeah.
You know, and just, and the controls were awful.
Yeah.
I mean, they really were. They were muddy and really sticky. Like, you swore somebody had just, you know, somebody drilled a hole into the interface and poured a whole barrel of molasses into it. That's how sticky the controls were.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was more or less the first sort of, the first sort of copy of Mortal Kombat we got back then, and it wasn't the last.
No.
But the thing was, most of the Mortal Kombat copies, unlike Time Killers, actually tried to do the digitized graphics thing that the guys at Midway did with Mortal Kombat, and they utterly failed with it every time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd get, like, some infamous examples. Kasumi Ninja for the Atari Jaguar.
Crotch fireballs for the win.
Yep. Crotch fireballs. Let's see, what else? You had Way of the Warrior for the 3DO.
Yeah.
Which was an early Naughty Dog.
Yeah.
That was an early Naughty Dog game.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
How far are they?
In fact, I think that was the game they released before they created Crash Bandicoot.
Yeah.
Probably the most infamous, though, that was so infamously bad that it didn't even get a wide release was Tattoo Assassins.
Yeah, I don't think that actually ever came out, though.
Well, it did and it didn't. There are a couple machines that are out there that I think were, like, put out for, like, testing purposes, but it was never getting a wide release. And if you ever get a chance to look at it on YouTube, or I'm pretty sure there's a couple of websites that are dedicated entirely to the debacle that was this game, you will very quickly understand why.
Yeah.
This thing was a turd. I mean, there is no other way to put it. This game was a complete and utter turd. Digitization was terrible, so much so that when they showed the character bios, because, you know, these old fighting games, you know, when it was running in demo mode, you would see character bios and profiles and stuff show up on the screen every so often. The digitization was so bad that they actually had to physically draw in the character's eyes.
Yeah.
That's how bad it was. And, you know, that's not even counting just the actual content itself. The game, for obviously, the animation was terrible, and the characters were so stupid and very in timely in the moment kind of way. One of the characters was basically meant a sort of ripoff of Nancy Kerrigan, because, you know, this was the around the time of
Olympic. That whole Olympic debacle.
Nancy Kerrigan. Yeah, and you know, that character was supposed to be a member of the Yakuza, who was obviously a one with a Fu Manchu mustache. And then, of course, you know, there was the boss characters, which was like, it was just weird. The boss characters, like, the first one was like some dude in a zombie costume. The other was like some bodybuilder cyclops chick with a unicorn horn. Thing that was made out of crystal for the skull that you had to be tiny people. And then there was the final boss, who was basically just a guy with hypodermic needles for fingers.
Yeah.
And then there was the fact that, you know, the one of the big boasts of this game was that it had over 200 fatalities.
Yeah. Most of which didn't
and
work.
Most of which didn't work. And were completely nonsensical. Everything from know, turning your opponent to a running hot dog, to dropping one of the burgers from Burger Time on top of them.
Yeah.
The one where it would suddenly start shitting out a whole bunch of turkeys for reason.
Yeah.
I don't know what that one was about. Or the one that would make them turn into some weird two-headed Barney the Dinosaur freak.
Yeah.
It was weird and it was stupid. Yeah. But, you know, the thing was, back then, the way that the gaming business was, there was a place for all those sort of B and Z grade games, you know, and those places were in the arcade, you know. And you could find some real gems in those games sometimes. One that I've often harped on is Bloodstorm. Bloodstorm, oddly enough, was another game made by the same guys who made Time Killers, but it is far superior in almost every way, graphically, control-wise. The game was just loaded with secrets, including one secret where you could actually play as a character with Joe Lieberman's head, oddly enough.
Yeah.
All kinds of finishing moves and stage fatalities and like over a dozen hidden characters. You know, and, you know, those games, they only got to shine in the arcades.
Yeah.
And when the arcades went away, that sort of place for those games went away, too.
Yeah.
And we're probably never going to be able to see something like that again. You know, the best we'll ever get is in virtual arcades, but those virtual arcades, as fun as they are and as great as they are for able to, you know, give in developer a chance to get their projects released, you know, it'll never be able to equal the arcade experience. And I know I sound kind of like an old man about this stuff, but it's true. Yeah. You know, my hope is that one day arcades will sort of make something of a comeback, but I honestly don't see that happening anytime soon.
Yeah.
So
that's my piece. Because it was really, arcades were kind of like, well, I guess you could call them kind of like a microcosm of the gaming industry as a whole back then. You really saw the good and the bad of the industry all in, you know, basically one building.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you could pretty much, you know, the arcade games that were successful, you know, they would be successful first in the arcades and then they would make their way over to consoles. If a game wasn't successful in the arcades, that was it.
Yeah, just didn't show up.
It just disappeared. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not talking about all the games that necessarily sucked. I mean, Bloodstorm was great and it never made it past the arcades.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, eventually, you know, fighting games sort of faded away. Or, you know, well, I say that, but not exactly. Fighting games did kind of get a second lease on life in the arcades right around the time when Virtua Fighter came into existence. And kind of hard for people to relieve. You know, when you look back at Virtua Fighter now, it looks really rough. I mean, it really does.
Yeah, it hasn't aged well.
Yeah, and especially, you know, some of the controls can be really floaty.
Yep.
Especially jumping. I mean, they basically hovered in the air for you jumped and it would take about half an hour for you to come back down. Yeah. But
well, the first three games took place on the moon. I don't think many people know that.
But, you know, and you look back at that and see it's rough, may not realize this, but, you know, Yu Suzuki actually had to get some of the hardware from Lockheed Martin to make that game.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know who Lockheed Martin is, they're arms manufacturers.
Yeah.
They're the guys that make all the computer systems for the ballistic missiles that your government uses right now.
Hmm.
That's where he had to get the technology from.
Yeah.
But it was a success.
And because of that, then there was a bunch of Virtua Fighter clones that would come out later. Many of them actually quite good.
Yeah, we got Tekken.
In hindsight. Tekken. Dead or Alive. Let's see.
Soul Calibur.
Oh, there was a... Yeah, Soul Calibur. Especially the first game, Soul Edge. Soul Blade, as it was known on the consoles. Speaking of which, I love the console version of Soul Edge. It was, I mean, it had interactive endings.
Yeah,
you know, that was good fun.
Yeah, Soul Edge was kind of where the console started catching up. If you ask.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And let's see, Tekken. Then there were sort of the games that are sort of lesser known, like Fighting Vipers.
Yeah.
That's a game a lot of people don't remember. But for its time, it was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Distribution just.
Again, also. Yeah. And, you know, that's yet another one of those examples where, you know, why is it that all the Japanese rock stars and Japanese media look so crazy? Well, that's because that's what they actually looked like back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
I don't know how many of them actually walked around with a guitar strapped to their back.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, there was some of the other games that came out around that time, too. A lot of people don't remember. Like, who here remembers Versus?
I do.
That was the
Konami
Street Gang.
I
don't. Yeah, the Street Game, Street Gang fighting game that was... Actually, not too bad.
Yeah.
But it just didn't. Again, it was one of those games that just sort of sank into obscurity. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think the only thing that really saved, say, Fighting Vipers from obscurity was the Virtua Fighter versus Fighting Vipers game, the Fighters Mega Mix that came out for the Sega Saturn. I don't know how many people here remember that game. That game was freaking insane.
Yeah, that was
because it wasn't you didn't just have the characters from Virtua Fighter and Fighting Vipers. You also had freaking like God, what was it?
You had the Hornet from Daytona USA.
Yep.
Yeah, you had the Hornet from Daytona USA. You had what was his name? The superhero. Yep, the characters from Sonic Fighters, including Dynamite and. What was his name? It was the polar bear and the green bird that threw bombs. There was also that weird jalapeno / pinata looking character, which I can't remember for the life of me. All I remember is that, you know, you would knock the sombrero off his head and he'd have a rubber duck attached to his head. And then there was that that superhero character that was like battery powered or something. It was just weird, and, you know, there was a lot of, especially in Japan back then, there was a lot of those sort of Virtua Fighter clones that were of average to above average quality, but just sort of sank into obscurity. And it's really funny to realize this, but in Japan, Virtua Fighter is like an institution.
Still it really is.
It's a freaking cultural phenomenon over there,
yeah.
You know? You know, there's a reason why in Shenmue, you know, the guy could go up to a, you know, to, you know, Ryu could go up to one of those capsule machines like, you know, 10 years before the fact and get one of the Virtua Fighter figures in one of the capsules. It's because you'd go to the capsule machines in Japan and those things were there.
Yeah.
You know, they were freaking everywhere. Virtua Fighter still is. It had its own anime series. It, you know, for a series that originally had no storyline to speak of, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't really ascertain from the Virtua Fighter 2 instruction manual on the Sega Saturn.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't really even have a proper final boss. It just had a weird robot woman thing.
It would shake you down for your quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. But, you know, that was the arcades back then. And, you know, for all of, you know, the fact that, you know, sometimes, you know, those machines would wear down and over time, and which is important. It's one of those things where it's important that we preserve a lot of these things because, you know, that technology eventually wears out. And, you know, once the essential hardware for that stuff is no longer functional, those games are gone for good.
Yeah. Fortunately, there's a very dedicated, you know, community of people who are, you know, basically restoring arcade games, and granted, they're keeping them around their houses, or they're also making their own private arcades. So that's, that's a pretty cool, you know, phenomenon, if you ask me.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, I'd like to think that maybe, you know, Wreck-It Ralph kind of helped bring arcades back into public consciousness to an extent. So, you know, it'll have, maybe they'll come back at some point.
Yeah.
I would very much like to, because the arcade experience is something is like none other.
Yeah. It's just that very tangible, that very, you know, connection that you'll have with other people that you don't even know, but they're there for the same reason you are, just to hang out and have a good time.
Yeah.
As long as,
and unlike in the internet where you're completely anonymous, you know, when you're in the arcade, you know the bastard who called you a prick when he's
You know who they are, and you can punch them in the face. That's the great part about it. Not that not that we're condoning violence, but, you know, you could do that if you were so inclined.
If we must. Hint, hint. Keep in mind, you know, the security guard was a slow middle-aged man with a speech impediment, so you could probably run pretty fast and get away from That was my thing on arcades.
Yeah. Arcades were good times.
Yes.
Cool. Again, folks, remember, we're old.
Yes, we are very old. Do you want to take us into the next story, Pat? Wakey, wakey.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. I'm pretty out of it. So, Bethesda, in the wake of
E3. I was snoring earlier.
I was?
Yeah, I didn't mention it. We didn't mention it, but that's okay.
Oh, shit. Bethesda, in the wake of E3, a little bit unsure about whether or not they're going to do any future pressers.
Yeah, people are making this out to be more than it actually is, personally. Because from what I heard about the dude at Bethesda, he basically said, we're not going to rule it out. But if we've only got like two or three games to show, we're not going to bother doing an entire event.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So he says,
I wouldn't mind them keeping up this kind of flow.
Yeah. Well, it's all going to depend on, you know, what they've got to show next year. And if they have enough good titles that make it worthwhile, then, you know, they'll do their own event.
That's good.
Mm. Yeah.
But I was going to say, they did a great show.
Yeah, I mean, they pretty much kicked off what turned out to be a very solid E3 overall.
I don't think there could have been a better start to E3 than what Bethesda did.
Yeah.
I really set the tone for the whole week.
Yep. Yeah, and we lost Brandon again because Skype hates us, apparently.
Apparently. Yeah. When I got kicked off earlier, it was giving me some sort of weird error that I had to shut down my recorder to fix. So I don't know what that was about. So,
yeah, that's Bethesda. They're not sure, but, you know, I'm fairly certain that by the time next year rolls around, they're not a company that's going to sit still. So,
especially now that they've got so many subsidiaries.
Okay, so DualShockers wrote a pretty interesting article about, you know, the challenges for Sony to get backwards compatibility for PS3 games onto the PS4, and they suggested a possible solution. Okay.
Well, they glanced on a couple of things, one of which was just using the PlayStation Now service as a back end to allow people play games for free by having the corresponding disc in the drive of their PS4, which is a good idea. But they also talked about the brute force method of just using raw power of the hardware to emulate consoles that are much older rather than just a little bit. And I think they didn't explore that well enough, and that was kind of a shame because it really hinted at what could be a really good a good system for implementing backward compatibility almost as a rule moving forward.
You keep, but if you keep the systems a couple of steps behind, like for example, you know, you have the PS4 emulating the PS2.
Yeah,
there's more than enough power there to handle that.
Yeah, because looking at it realistically, the reasons it's difficult and a little bit contentious, costs of emulation development may outweigh benefits of implementation, particularly when you have to emulate things on a game by game basis, and you know, all the problems that have proven to creep up from that, especially with the Xbox 360 emulating Xbox Legacy. Another issue is obviously that Legacy hardware still at retail does still need to be sold through to the consumer, which is a more, you know, pragmatic way of looking at it. But I'm pretty sure that has been brought up at more than a couple board meetings.
Yeah. Well, PS3,
so those are
still on store shelves, and they kind of want to move them.
Yep. And so that kind of gives them a bit of an incentive not to implement backward compatibility, at least to the PS3, in the PS4. You know, by the same token, backward compatibility matters because some of us have sunk massive amounts of money into these past generations, and we need the, you know, the hardware available that's going to allow us to support that. And so, you know, with long-term failure being inevitable, as systems get littered with moving parts, we need real and you know, definitive answers regarding the security of our investment. So, it seems to me that the obvious answer is to keep backward compatibility a generation behind. PS3 hardware is not going to mass fail during 8th gen. Xbox 360s are not going to mass fail during 8th gen.
No, they already did that.
Yeah. They got that out of the system. You know, they got a couple new waves of hardware out. The Xbox 360s that we have now are probably pretty safe, at least for the next 5 to 10 years or so. Beyond that, maybe not so much. And that's where you start looking to backward compatibility to be the solution. You know, when the PS5 comes along, it should be able to brute force those PS3 games despite the unique cell architecture. Just as the PS4 should be more than enough to emulate the PS2 despite the emotion engine. And, you know, we should probably also bring up that the Xbox One should be able to brute force legacy Xbox games without, you know, tailor-made emulators for, on a game-by-game basis. So,
The Xbox One should actually have an easier time of it, since the architecture between the Xbox One and the original Xbox, granted there are evolutions of each other, but it's basically the same instruction set between the two. So,
it's just so much the better.
Yeah, it's just going to be a matter of adapting the APIs at that point.
Yeah. So at that point, you know, there's really no excuse not to implement the backward compatibility when you're going beyond a generation back. And, you know, people already have these vast libraries of games for those systems. maybe this is probably the quickest, easiest, and cheapest way to implement backward compatibility while still addressing the needs of the hardware manufacturers to still push that legacy hardware still at retail and to not make it a major production to get entire libraries of relatively recent games supported.
So it's backwards, going around the horn here, is backwards compatibility is something that's very important for you guys personally?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For me, I think it's well documented.
Most definitely. It's...
Go ahead, Brandon.
No, I was done.
Okay. Pat, we know it's definitely important for you. What about Danrib?
I mean, I definitely think it's a big deal to an extent, but you look at last generation as an example. I mean, the PS3 was backwards compatible for a while, and then they moved into the PS3 Slim, where they got rid of the feature. Xbox 360, similar, except there were a handful of Xbox games that were backward compatible with it. And I think last generation was a good indicator of whether or not the feature is actually needed. I mean, you can go ahead and cite Nintendo for their success with the Wii with their backward compatibility with GameCube games. But after the Wii sales started to trail off, the only consistent ones there were Sony and Microsoft. And Microsoft was already well ahead of the game. At the same time, I'm not a numbers guy. I don't know how many people on the Xbox went up to the Xbox 360. So in regards to backwards compatibility, it's definitely important for gamers in the sense where, you want to continue to play the games you have on your newest consoles. But honestly, to me, there's nothing wrong with hooking up your old things and trying to go from there. Whether or not it fails is a total separate issue entirely. But yeah, that's what I think about that. I mean, I think it's important. It's just not as important as we make it out to be.
Yeah.
My whole thing was the higher the failure rate over time of a given system, the more important the backward compatibility is. Like, you see systems like the PS1, this, Sega Saturn obviously is going to be any Sega platforms are going to be a problem, but even the GameCube, as soon as we get into those systems being, 10, 15 years old, the failure rates are going to go up higher. And I don't really think they should go 10 years without providing some sort of option to get a new device that can play those games, because moving parts are becoming more and more of a thing, at least until we move on to flash memory as more of a standard. But there's a reason I have a closet full of PS2s, and I don't like
that. Kidding, folks.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah,
shitty hardware.
Yeah. Because I don't want the day to come when, the 200 some odd PS2 games I own are just impossible to play because all my PS2s have gone out on me, and finding a working one is no longer a simple matter of just going across the street to Fun Unlimited and buying another one off the shelf.
Then going back to last era again. Hold on a fuck. I lost my trail of thought.
That does happen.
Because of your PS2s, man. We'll get back to you.
Okay.
Yeah. For me, I generally keep all my old systems. And, I'm technical minded enough that I can, go in there and actually figure out what's wrong with them. So, for me, there's that.
But if you needed a part or something.
Yeah, well, unless it's one of the custom chips that happen to be on those systems, RAM chips, those are pretty standard. Disk drive motors, those are pretty standard. Lasers are pretty standard. These things can be repaired and replaced. Then you can also, if you find a broken system that has a different problem than what you have, You probably can take parts off of that and get yours going, you know? So I don't think it's the end of the world, but for me, it's more a matter of convenience, because after a while, you end up with like five or six systems hooked up to your TV, and it just gets a little unwieldy.
Yeah, I don't know about five or six being excessive, but once you get up to seven, eight, nine systems hooked up, then there's a little bit of a problem. And so...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Here's that.
Okay, I remembered.
So, okay.
Again, going back into last generation, for console gamers, that was pretty much the first time where, you know, we had the ability to buy games digitally. Console gamers. So looking at backwards compatibility now, when Microsoft made their announcement, I was ecstatic. I mean, those of you that know me know my Xbox 360 does not get any action except for the indies and the point-and-click titles that I've downloaded off of the Xbox Live Arcade.
Yeah.
So if I get to, you know, actually download all those games back onto my Xbox One, I'm a happy camper. I can sell my Xbox 360 without worrying about it, and there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as it stands now, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah.
And the stuff that's digitally, you know, purchased on your account, the ones that are, you know, actually marked for backwards compatibility, they just show up in your, you know, in your library.
Yeah.
As you saw in the piece that I did.
In fact, you don't have to rebuy it. It's totally awesome.
Yeah.
Yep.
And of course, I demonstrated it with Defense Grid because that's what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I just thought, going back to the original point, I thought it was an interesting article by Dual Shockers that puts the whole thing in pretty good perspective and explains why Sony in particular might be a little bit reluctant to take that step. And I think Shu Yoshida's immediate response to hearing about Microsoft implementing it was quite telling.
Holy crap, that was probably a lot of work.
he was more impressed than anything.
Yeah.
Let's just say the Xbox One is nowhere near what it was supposed to be 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, they pretty much relaunched it.
Yeah, they really did.
We finally graduated from the last remains of Don Matrick's Xbox One and arrived at Phil Spencer's, which is vastly superior.
Yeah. Yeah, now if you'll only, you know, let you use Cortana without having to have a Kinect, that'd be nice. To be fair, they haven't specifically said that you absolutely need it, but they're not saying that you don't.
Yeah. I thought I heard him say that once, but I think the alternative would be walking around with a headset on all the time.
Yeah. Well, there are folks that do that.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Don't you have the Kinect?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Remember, a few weeks back, it actually turned on my Xbox.
Oh, Wii. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, anytime you say Xbox, oops, it's on.
Or listening to something that involves the words Xbox on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going through my headset now, so it's not going to hear me, so thankfully.
That's good.
Yeah. All right. Is that what we got for this week?
We got a show.
Yeah. Cool.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Cool. I'll let you wrap it up, Pat.
Well, not a whole lot to say. This has been Let's Weekend, and we hope to see you Sunday when we. Oh, what are we talking about on the Day Zero update? We've got the Batman debacle. A lot of Nintendo stuff. Yu Suzuki explaining Shenmue 3 stuff and some Doom 4 news. So,
yep.
Yeah, should be a good show.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
So, with that, we hope to see you Sunday.
Take
care, everybody.
Later, folks.
Peace.